my strong arms. Wah, wah, wah. Cry, cry, cry. Pick you up, rock you in my strong arms. Wait a minute, those sounds you're making, they could be music. They're good enough, I'll take them. My instrument is across the room. You're in between us, making yelps and coos. If I can't get to it, I have to use you. Cause you take up all my time, and somehow I gotta get to it. If you can't beat them, join them. If you can't beat them, join them. If I can't get to a pen, what do I do? All this music in my head, somehow I gotta unscrew it. Unfinished thoughts, half-written words, crawl away from my drum and no one gets hurt. Smoke signals in the plumes of laundry. I've spelled out SOS with mashed up peas. But when I saw you needing me, I needed you, you were in reach. There is no shame in my approach. You make such beautiful notes. Tap on your belly, raspberry your thigh. You make high notes when you laugh and low ones when you sigh. And when you sleep, it's like a rest. And when you dream upon my chest, you breathe my songs, breathe my songs alive. Breathe my songs, breathe my songs alive. If you can't beat them, join them.
Cry, cry, cry.
If you can, if you can't beat them, join them. Pencil tip dots, hundreds of burns, all in one motion, dipping and turning. Black and white
cards thrown into the wind, flapping their wings in perfect unison. Bobbit moves up and down, swelling, deflating, fast motion cloud. How did they do that? Who is the leader? They're all calibrated to some cosmic meter.
Aquarium, belly full of water. Good morning. I'm Reverend Shana Appel, a pastor at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Milford and co-host of the podcast, What in God's Name? And this morning, moderator for the Monadnock Lyceum. I'm pleased to welcome you all here this morning with our guest speaker, Paula Stone Williams. But before we get started, I'd like to thank this morning's musician, Tara Greenblatt, and her band for recording that awesome music many of you enjoyed while waiting for the live broadcast to begin. Also, thank you to Putnam Foundation, New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, for generously sponsoring today's event. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire and active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. We deeply appreciate your donations, which this year may be made on our website or by mailing your donation. During this challenging time, we need your help more than ever. Thank you in advance for your generosity. Today's talk is being recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. The talk will be rebroadcast on WUML 91.5 next Wednesday at 10:30 in the morning, next Sunday at 3 in the afternoon, and also on WSMN 95.3 next Sunday at 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. As is the tradition of the Lyceum, after today's presentation, our speaker will answer some questions from the audience. We ask that you submit your questions by using the live comments section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email at monadnocklyceum@gmail.com. After the broadcast, you may provide feedback on today's program, suggestions for next summer speakers, or join the mailing list through our website. Our speaker today is the Reverend Dr. Paula Stone Williams. Let me just say that in the gospel bearing his name, the Apostle John wrote, "And you will know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Or as is most often quoted from the King James Version of Scripture, "Know ye the truth, and the truth shall set ye free." But in these days, wherein truth itself has become painfully relative, that is a particularly poignant perspective. I believe more often than not these days, ye knoweth the truth, and the truth shall make you nuts. But between the truth that liberates and the truth that tests, there is a thin road called integrity. And that road calls its travelers to a place of authenticity, no matter what. Our guest this morning knows this thin road well. Dr. Paula Stone Williams was once the mightily successful CEO of a religious nonprofit, pastor of a megachurch, host of her own TV show, until integrity called her to that thin road. On the journey towards authenticity, Paula lost all of those jobs and even, for a time, relationship with family members and friends. The thin road is not an easy one to travel, but if the going is tough, it is also rewarding in wisdom, insight, knowledge, redemption, and yes, freedom. Paula is here this morning to share with us tales from her life travels and some of the wisdom she has accrued along the way. My friends, we are truly blessed to have Paula with us today, and I just wish we could all be together in the beautiful sanctuary of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Peterborough, New Hampshire, where we normally host the Lyceum, because I know you would all join me in a warm, warm welcome. Paula, welcome to the Lyceum. It is truly an honor to be with you this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to today so much. You know, you talk about truth. I believe the truth does set you free, but I also know that it pretty much is going to make you miserable first. I think that's why so many people avoid it. And I know a little bit about the truth making one miserable. I was the CEO of a large religious nonprofit, the host of a national television show, the editor at large of a national magazine. I was a successful, well-educated white American male. But the poet and mystic Thomas Merton said it's a difficult thing to climb to the top of the ladder of success, only to realize when you get there that your ladder's been leaning against the wrong wall. I knew from the time I was 3 or 4 years of age I was transgender. In my naivete, I thought I got to choose. I thought a gender fairy would arrive and say, okay, what's it going to be? But alas, no gender fairy arrived. So I just lived my life. I didn't hate being a boy, just knew I wasn't one. Went to college, got married, had kids, built a career. But the call toward authenticity has all the subtlety of a smoke alarm, and eventually decisions have to be made. And so I came out as transgender and promptly lost every single one of my jobs. I had never had a bad review, and I lost every single job. In all 50 states of the United States, you can't be fired for being transgender, but in all 50, you can be fired if you're transgender and you work for a religious corporation. Good to know. It's not easy being a transgender woman. People often ask me, do you feel 100% like a woman? I say, well, if you've talked to one transgender person, you've talked to exactly one transgender person. I'm not going to try to speak for anyone else. I feel 100% like a transgender woman. There are things a cisgender woman knows I will never know. That said, I'm learning a lot about what it means to be a woman, and I'm learning a lot about my former gender, and I'm here to tell you the differences are massive. Let's start with the little things, like, oh, let's say, the pockets of women's jeans. I mean, someone should have told me about this. I used to wear Bill's khakis, which have pockets down to the knees. I mean, you could hold your phone, your keys, a couple of hammers. The pockets on a woman's jeans are utterly, completely useless. Maybe a couple of paper clips. I mean, why do they even have them? I bought a pair of jeggings. They have stitching there that makes you think there's a pocket, but oh no, there's no pocket there. They're fooling you. So a couple of years ago, I spoke for the Levi's Corporation headquarters. I thought, now I can find out what's going on with the pockets on women's jeans. But of course, no one there seemed to know. If they did, they were keeping it to themselves. Or the size of a woman's wardrobe. When as a guy, I had a couple of pairs of jeans, a couple of pairs of khakis, a blue sport coat. What did you really need? As a woman, I have closets and closets full of clothes because people notice if you've worn something too often. Well, men don't notice, but women notice, and they judge you for it. Here's a phrase you will never hear spoken to a man. You will never hear anyone say to a man, oh, yeah, that's not a good haircut for a guy over 50. You'll never hear that because we don't care if a man looks like he's over 50 or 60 or 70 for that matter. But as a woman, people say to me all the time, who's your hairdresser? As if to say, do you really even have a hairdresser? And if you do, does she know you're over 50? You know, I was with one of my best friends, a woman, not too long ago, and I tucked in my shirt, and as I came out of the bedroom, she looked at me and she said, should you really tuck in that shirt? Now, here's the truth. There are many times I wish someone had said to a man, should you really tuck in that shirt? But no one would dare ever say that to a man. But a woman, of course, it's all fair game. There's no way a well-educated white male can understand how much the culture is tilted in his favor. There's no way he can understand it because it's all he's ever known and it's all he ever will know. And conversely, there's no way that a woman can understand the full import of that because being a woman's all she's ever known. I mean, she might have an inkling she's working twice as hard for half as much, but she really has no idea how much harder it is for her than it is for the guy in the Brooks Brothers jacket in the office across the hall. I know. I was that guy. And once I transitioned, oh, that wake-up call came very quickly. I was flying from Denver to Charlotte, the very first time I ever flew as Paula, and I got on the plane and there was some stuff in my seat, so I picked it up and put my stuff down, and the guy about my age said, lady, that's my stuff. I said, okay, but it's in my seat, so I'll be glad to hold it for you till you find your seat. He said, lady, that is my seat. I said, actually, it's not. It's my seat, 1D, but like I said, I'll be happy to hold your stuff till you find your seat. He said, I don't know what I needed to tell you. That is my seat. I said, yeah, actually, it's not. At which point, the guy behind me said, lady, would you take your effing argument elsewhere so I can get in the plane? I was stunned. I had never been treated like that as a man. I can tell you exactly what would have happened. I would have said, excuse me, I believe that's my seat. And immediately, the guy would have looked at his boarding pass and said, oh, I'm sorry, I know that, because it happened scores of times. The flight attendant finally decided to do her job, and took our boarding passes, said to the guy, "Sir, you're in 1C, she's in 1D." I put his stuff down in 1C, no thank you, no I'm sorry, no nothing from him. And of course, you know who was next to me in 1F. It was Mr. Would you take your effing argument elsewhere. My friend Karen came onto the plane to give the paperwork to the captain. She works for American Airlines, and she waved goodbye as she left. I got to Charlotte. Karen called me. She said, "What happened? You were as white as a sheet." I told her, and she said, "Oh, yeah, welcome to the world of women. Now, the truth is, I will not live long enough to lose my male privilege. I know that. I brought it with me when I transitioned. But that doesn't mean I don't see my entitlement, my privilege diminishing. So I'm on the board of a sizable nonprofit, and we have a large annual conference. We hired a new CEO. We were talking about the wisdom of having her do a keynote message for our conference that year. And I said, "Well, she's not a seasoned speaker. It might be better if we do an interview, and I'd be happy to interview her." I said, "But if you do want her to do a keynote, I'll be happy to coach her." At which point, a powerful white male in the room, as a matter of fact, a McKinsey partner, said, "Well, if we're going to do that, why don't we hire a real coach?" I've done 4 TED Talks. I have coached TEDx speakers. I'm a speaker's ambassador for TED. I've taught speech in 3 universities, 2 in the United States, 1 in Europe. Tell me, what about that does not make me a real coach? I didn't say anything, though. I kept waiting for one of the women to speak up on my behalf, but that's something I notice women don't do for one another, so I just stayed quiet because I knew if I did speak up, well, I was just going to be interrupted. And now if I spoke up, I'd become that woman. You know what I'm talking about. You know, if there's just one thing I wish I could go back and tell Paul, just one thing, it would be to assume that a woman knows what she's talking about and treat her accordingly. That alone would go a very long way. Well, that and stop interrupting us. I mean, really, just stop. Just stop interrupting us. You know, I wish I could go back and tell Paul 3, I think, really important lessons. First of all, I wish I could go back and tell Paul the importance of deference. Deference is not a respected male trait. Men see deference as weakness. But until men see deference as a respected male trait, we're not ever going to get anywhere near genuine gender equity. So how can a man begin to learn to show deference? I think the first step is to become an ally, to say to the women in his life, "I'm here for you. I will do anything for you. I'm behind you. I will encourage you." But actually, that's not deference. Deference doesn't happen just by becoming an ally. Deference happens when you're willing to become an apprentice, when you're willing to say, "I know nothing about the female experience. I want to fight for the rights of women or people of color or any group that's a minority. And yet I don't know anything about it. And so I will work at your direction. You tell me what you need me to do. I will be your apprentice. I will be your accomplice. I will be your assistant to give up your own power and hand it to the women in your life." That, my friends, is deference. The second thing I wish I could go back and tell Paul is to learn the value of the 3 C's: compromise, collaboration, and correction. Now, let me ask you a question. What do Norway, Finland, Germany, Iceland, Taiwan, and New Zealand have in common? All 6 countries did very well through the first phase of the coronavirus. All 6 countries also happen to have a woman as a head of state. And all 6 of those women understood the value of collaboration. They didn't look at the heads of their health departments as subordinates reporting to them. They saw them as equals and let them take the lead. They were willing to compromise, not looking for perfect answers, but looking for the best answer under the circumstances. And every one of them was willing to be quickly corrected. Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand was wonderful. As soon as she realized they were headed the wrong direction, she said, I made a mistake there. We're headed in the wrong direction. Yeah, did you hear that from the leaders of, oh, let's say, Brazil, the United States, or Great Britain? Three of the nations that did absolutely horribly through the first phase and second phase of the coronavirus? No. Apparently, those egos weren't able to be that open and honest and open to correction. The third thing I wish I could go back and say to Paul is I wish I really had learned to listen, to truly and deeply listen. I would always listen, and I thought I was listening well. In fact, I was talking to my former executive assistant not long ago. We had a delightful two-hour conversation, and she said, well, I've watched your stuff online. I've read some of your stuff. The book hadn't come out yet, but she said, I'll read the book when it comes out, but I have to be honest, you're a little bit tough on yourself, except in one area. She said, you did not listen well. We would come to you with a question, and you would give us an absolutely brilliant answer to a question we were not asking. I know. It's exactly what I did. You know, I'm a therapist by trade. My doctorate is in pastoral counseling. And I work from a psychodynamic perspective of patient-centered therapy, which means that I don't have any answers for my clients. My clients have their own answers. And my job is just to help them remove the obstacles that are stopping them from finding their own answers. Guess what? You can't do that if you don't listen deeply. And I'll tell you a little secret. You could pretty much do away with our entire profession if we would just listen deeply to everyone in our close circle, to everyone in our lives. Because that's truly what a good therapist does, is hear you when no one else has truly heard you. I wish I could go back and say to Paul, you've got to learn to listen. Now, I see a lot of you women out there saying, yeah, guys, I hope you're listening to this. You need to learn deference, and you need to learn compromise and collaboration and correction. You really need to learn to listen. Yeah, thank you, Paula. Yeah, sorry, I got some things for the women, too. First, no one told me that women do not empower one another, that instead women see each other as competition. I've had more conflict with women in 6 years as a woman than I had with women in 60 years as a man. I was interviewed for an article last week in the Washington Post by K.K. Otteson, who's an absolutely wonderful reporter and photographer. And I was talking with her about this, and she said, it's not my experience that women don't support one another. I find that they do. She called me back a couple of days later. Or I think actually I called her back. We were talking a couple of days later, and she said, oh, by the way, I was talking to Madeleine Albright yesterday, as one does. And she said, I was talking with her about this, and she said, oh, don't you remember me always saying that there's a special place in hell reserved for women who do not empower one another? It's been shocking to me how much women don't empower one another. Men do empower one another. Here's what men do. Men come into a room, and the first thing they do is identify who the alpha is in the room. Then they rank themselves generously according to that alpha's location, and then they set about accomplishing the purposes of the alpha. Or to put it in a U.S. sports analogy, they get in a huddle, slap each other in the butt, and then advance the quarterback and the ball down the field. Men have no problem doing this until it's time to get rid of the quarterback and bring in a new one. Men empower one another. Women don't. They see each other as competition. You don't really have to look all that deeply to understand the reason. 5.8% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women. 6.6% of Silicon Valley CEOs are women. 22% of Silicon Valley senior vice presidents are women. The average woman in the United States, white woman, earns 81 cents in the dollar of what the average man earns. Black woman, 64 cents in the dollar. Native American woman, 59 cents in the dollar. Hispanic American woman, 54 cents in the dollar. At the rate we're going, it'll be 100 years before we have pay equity. let alone any other kind of equity. 47% of first-year law associates are women, but only 15% make partner. 3% of venture capital goes to female-founded firms. Did you know that mothers with children at home are 44% less likely to be hired for a job, even though they are excellent multitaskers? They're extremely capable at taking the right kinds of risks, and they bring snacks to the office. I mean, really, what else could one ask? I understand why women see each other as competition. The world has not been fair to women. I brought a lot of privilege with me. There are a lot of ways in which I still know how to control a room, how to get what I want. And yet most women have been taught since childhood that that's not the case. I had all five of my granddaughters with me for the last 3 weeks. They're all between 10 and 13 years of age. And one of the things I noticed they constantly did was apologize for themselves. Now, all five of these girls have fierce fathers and very fierce mothers, and yet their culture still has taught them to apologize for themselves. You don't have to apologize for yourself. You definitely don't have to apologize when you're right. And yet, how often do you say, "I'm sorry, guys, but I don't think these numbers add up"? I hope my granddaughters learn to stand strong and not apologize for themselves. I wish that women would support one another. The second thing that I wish women would do is learn to say, "I've got this." This is actually why women apologize for themselves, because they're not taught to say, "I've got this." We teach our sons to be confident. We teach our daughters to be perfect. We say to our daughters, "Life's going to be more difficult for you, and so you really have got to work harder than your brother does, because you need to be at the very top." And it works fine throughout their education system. They end up valedictorian of the class. It's wonderful. Then they get their first job out in the corporate world. A position opens up. It has five requirements. A woman has four of the five, and she thinks to herself, "Oh, I can't apply for that job. I don't have the fifth." Because she's been taught to be perfect. A man, on the other hand, says, "Hey, I got two of the five. I got this." He applies for the job. He gets the job she did not even apply for, even though he's exactly half as qualified. We got to stop teaching our daughters to be perfect. Instead, teach our daughters to be persistent. And then I think the important thing is to own what you know. Own what you know. You know, I was an alpha male, and I never had any difficulty as an alpha male. I'm an alpha female, and guess what? The world doesn't always respond well to alpha females. And so you begin to diminish yourself. I cannot tell you how much confidence I've lost in just 7 years as a woman that I had gained very quickly as a man. It is difficult for me to find the courage to stand up for myself and say, "Oh, as a matter of fact, I am a speaker's coach. I do know what I'm talking about. So you might want to think twice before you say something next time." It's difficult for us to own what we know. But you know, I think all of us, male, female, non-binary, I think all of us need to find the courage to answer the call onto the hero's journey. The hero's journey is common for every age, every language, every ethnicity, every people group. It always has the same elements. An ordinary citizen is called onto an extraordinary journey under the road of trials. And initially they reject the call because, hey, it's the road of trials. Nobody's stupidly going to go in the road of trials. And so you reject the call, but now you know you've been called. There's no question you've been called. And you rejected the call, and now you're utterly and completely miserable. And then a spiritual guide comes into your life. Yoda, maybe your grandmother, maybe that mentor you had in college. But a spiritual guide comes into your life and gives you the courage to answer the call under the road of trials. And sure enough, you say yes to the hero's journey, and you're on the road of trials. And it's not very pleasant. And then it gets worse. Always on the hero's journey, it gets worse. you find yourself in a deep, dark cave, black, where the true way is wholly lost. It's what Dante was talking about at the beginning of the Divine Comedy when he said, in the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood where the true way was wholly lost. Been there. It's what John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul. But here's the thing. It's all right to be in the deep, dark cave. It's all right to be lost, because lost is a place too. Lost is a place too. And sometimes you have to spend some time in that place called lost. Sometimes an hour, sometimes a week, sometimes a month, sometimes a year. But sometimes you have to spend time in that place called lust, and there are things you can learn there you cannot learn any other way. I think it's why Rilke wrote the poem, The Man Watching. It ends with these lines, winning does not tempt that man. This is how he grows, by being defeated decisively by constantly greater beings. There are things you can learn in the place called lust you cannot learn any other way. And then finally, you see the light at the end of the tunnel. And this time it's not an oncoming train. And you get back onto the ordinary road of trials, and now that feels like nothing, given what you've been through. And finally, you make your way to the Holy Grail, to the prize of great price. But even then, the hero's journey is not done. You have a responsibility now to take the Holy Grail and return and give it as an offering to those from whom you have departed. Only then are you able to move on? Now, here's the thing. Everybody's been called onto the hero's journey. Everybody. Most of us, more than once. The question isn't whether you're called or not. The question is whether you find the courage to answer the call onto the hero's journey. Most of us don't. And you know you've not answered that call when you wake up in the morning and only 50% of yourself needs to get out of bed, because that's actually all that's required to get through the day you've fashioned for yourself. The long day is over, you get back in bed, the other half of you says, well, was it worth it? And you say, well, I stayed safe. Well, the safest place I know is a cemetery. We've all been called on the hero's journey. And the call never stops. The question isn't whether you're called or not. The question is whether you'll answer that call. It was 10 years ago. I was watching my favorite television show of all time, Lost. I think one of the best shows that's ever been on broadcast TV. There comes a point in the final season in which the protagonist, Jack, if you're a Lost fan, realizes he's been called by the God figure to die. When I saw that show, I collapsed on the floor. Because I knew I had been called to die. I sobbed for hours, fell asleep on the couch, woke up at 4, sobbed till dawn. It was another 2 years before I began hormones and another year and a half before I actually transitioned, because, well, after you've experienced the call under the hero's journey, life steps in. You know, you have to fix the blinds that are crooked in the kitchen and fix the grandkids' breakfast and put them to bed. And then again, one day, that voice speaks to you and says, oh, don't forget the call. And you answer the call. When I did my first TED Talk, the one that's been viewed over 4 million times, you have to memorize a TED Talk word for word. I'm a pastor. I've always memorized my sermons, memorized all my talks, but word for word is tough. You have to do it that way because it's going to be translated into scores of languages. I kept losing my place in the session, in the final dress rehearsal. I kept losing my place, highly unusual. And I was fortunate enough to have the head of coaching for TED, Breyer Goldberg, who's a friend of mine now, working with me. And I said, I need a transition sentence there, Breyer. I can't find it. About 1 in the morning, it came to me. I got her permission the next morning to insert it, and I used it in my next TED Talk, and my next, the one that's not recorded, down at the TED Summit. It's actually the dedication line in my book, As a Woman. The call toward authenticity is sacred and holy and for the greater good. The call toward authenticity is sacred and holy and for the greater good. So my father is a fundamentalist pastor. My mother was even more conservative than my father. And she demanded that he disown me when I transitioned. I knew that was likely to happen. I also knew my father's heart. So on his 93rd birthday, a couple of years after I transitioned, I called him. He took my call. We talked for about a half hour. About a month later, I called and asked if I could come for a visit. To my surprise, he said yes, and then he called back, and to my surprise, said my mother had agreed to see me. I saw them a total of 3 times before they passed, my mother at 95, my father at 96. In that first meeting, toward the end of our time together, my father looked at me, earnestly said, Paula, he called me Paula. Paula, I don't understand this, but I am willing to try. My father was 93 years old, and he was willing to try to answer the call onto the hero's journey. We're all called, and you know what the call is. It's to the place where the world's deep hunger meets your deep gladness. Those are Frederick Buechner's words. The place where the world's deep hunger meets your deep gladness. That is where you were called. So I end with the words that come to my mind as I'm speaking. In words of Mary Oliver, one day you knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried, mend my life. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with the stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, a new voice, a new voice, a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own. It kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Thank you.
My goodness. Thank you, Paula Stone Williams, for that unbelievable session on your thoughts of gender inequity and what we can do about it. We do have some time for questions from the audience. And as our speaker responds to those already sent, you may continue to submit your questions on Facebook and YouTube comments or by sending an email to monlyceum@gmail.com, monlyceum at gmail.com. And while we're waiting for those questions to come in, Paula, I have one for you, if you don't mind. In its religious context, the word redemption is a rich one. And I heard you say in a TED talk that you gave with your son, Reverend Jonathan Williams, that we can only be redeemed, that is, essentially made whole, by traveling the thin road. And I'm wondering why you think that is so. And I'm also curious to know what you think that thin road might look like for those who wish to work for gender equality, equity. And those are not the same thing.
They are not, but they both are necessary.
Yes, they are.
I believe that the person of courage, the one willing to answer the call out of the hero's journey, will always have to come from the liminal space of bravery. You know, I live in the borderlands. My life is lived in the liminal space between male and female. But I think it's the borderland. I think it's the thin places. Wherever what we know as or experience as God or the universal spaghetti monster, I don't know, call it whatever you want. But we experience that force that takes us beyond our own abilities to find a strength that we could not find any other way. And I think that anytime you look at a person who's responded to the hero's journey, whether it's a kindergarten teacher or someone running for president of the United States, it always takes great confidence coupled with great humility to bring about any meaningful redemption. Those are paradoxical strengths. I find that in my experience, cisgender women have those strengths more often than cisgender men. I think it's because of the way in which women are raised. And as they find themselves, they find the confidence. The humility, I think, almost comes as a birthright. But I think that actually is where redemption comes from. It comes from those who show great confidence and great humility.
Thank you, Paula.
Thank you very much, Paula. We have a comment here from Karen Melito Hatcher, who just thanking you for the beautiful talk. A second, no other questions here, so if you don't mind, I'm going to just ask another one. As you were talking about how each gender lacks experience of the other's reality, what started to resonate for me is the current struggle we're having right now nationally around white supremacy, white privilege. And it seems to me that there's a lot of natural parallels there. I loved the whole piece you did on apprenticeship and was wondering, I mean, if you think it does in fact carry over, does it make sense that, you know, white people need to turn to people in the BIPOC community and say, I don't know what your experience is. Let me apprentice. let me come and work at your behest. You tell me what it is I need to do. Is that a parallel, or I'll leave it there.
When they have the strength to do so, but it's not their work to do. It's my work to do. And I need their guidance, but I may not need their guidance in a direct and personal way. I was listening to a person who works with churches on this subject in the greater Denver area. And she said, you white people need to get your blank together. And you're going to have to do that on your own. And I heard that loud and clear. I think we have to do that work on our own. But certainly, we're going to have direction of the BIPOC world. We need their help. We need their assistance. You know, I find that it comes to me most easily through narrative. Ta-Nehisi Coates' work for me speaks more deeply than some workbook. And those have their value as well. I think we're narrative-based creatures. We learn best through story. I mean, think about it. We don't sleep without dreaming, and we don't dream in mathematical equations. At least I don't know many people who do. We dream in stories. So the need for story is downright physiological. And I believe it's story that most often changes the narrative. And I believe that people do change, but not unless information comes to them in a non-threatening way. And this is one of the realities of the human experience. We do have the capacity to change. We don't change through argument, by the way. We don't change by being yelled at. We don't change through debates. Debates really never accomplished anything. They just create hardening of the categories. We change when we get new information that comes to us in a way that does not threaten our being. And so that's one of the reasons I'm willing to go into any environment and speak. I get paid a lot of money to speak at universities and corporations. But I'll go to Christian universities and speak pro bono, because I think if they have to see me and listen to me, then they're going to have to be confronted with a reality that I apparently am roughly as healthy or unhealthy a human as they are. And if they can see my humanity, that will bring about the change. I was asked to go to a Christian university in Pennsylvania last year. And they contacted me a couple of weeks ahead of time and said, oh, by the way, the administration's decided we are going to have someone else speak who does not believe that gender dysphoria is a legitimate diagnosis. You're good with that, right? And I said, well, if I were Black and speaking, would you have someone there who decided that being Black was not a legitimate diagnosis? I said, no, that's not a safe environment for me. And that's not allowing me just to tell my story. I think that's the way that most change occurs, is to listen to stories and then talk with one another about them.
Thanks, Paula. We have a question from an audience member who wants to know if our efforts at gender equity need to begin with passage of the ERA.
Oh, God, how I would love that. In the same way, I'd love to see the Equality Act passed. I've been very active in the Biden administration and spoke at a White House event with Rachel Levine and Pete Buttigieg a couple of weeks ago, where we were talking about that. It's true that the decision of the Supreme Court has given trans people a lot of rights that we didn't have before in the LGB population as well, but not the same rights that the Equality Act would give us. I think probably at this point, the ERA is a closer reach than the Equality Act. And I think they're both desperately needed. And I believe if we get one, we're likely to get the other. But with the kind of polarization we have right now, I'm not sure it's possible. Let's see if we can get an infrastructure package through first. And then if we can do that, maybe baby steps will take us there. But we might have missed the window for the Equal Rights Act.
Paula, we have another audience member who wants to know, how can women begin to talk about their lack of support for each other?
I think to name it when it happens. I have an entire chapter in my book. The book is As a Woman, What I Learned About Power, Sex, and the Patriarchy After I Transitioned. It's published last month by Simon & Schuster. And the first 15 chapters are my own story. They're my own narrative. Chapters 16 and 17 are about gender equity. 18 and 19 are about religion and why religion behaves the way that it does in our nation. Chapter 20 is about experiencing my sexuality as a male and as a female. And then chapter 21 kind of wraps it all up. But, oh, gee, now I forgot the question.
It has to do with how women can begin to talk about our lack of support for each other.
Chapter 15 of the book. Oh, it's very easy to have lost that train of thought because it's one of the most painful chapters in the whole book. And it's about a failure to resolve conflict with a close woman friend and the devastation of that. And it's a relationship, a friendship that still has not been restored. And if that has taught me anything, it's that I don't much know the answer to that question. Other than to find the courage to keep on talking and to name it when you see it.
Paula, how do you think your life choices would have been different if you had been born a woman?
My mother was born in central Kentucky and born into a fundamentalist family and born in 1926. And she was profoundly ill. And her mental illness made it difficult for her to parent and difficult to function. There were wounds extremely early in life that I do not know the nature of, never will, and from which she never recovered. But I look at who she was on her better days. I look at her intelligence, her sense of humor, her insight, discernment, and recognize that, oh, a good half of what made her life so difficult was that she was born a woman in Kentucky in 1926. And the life that I live now is a life she would have given anything to have. And it's handed to me because I was born a man and transitioned. And know stuff that not very many people know. So I've been given this huge platform because I was a man. and how she would have given anything for that. Had I been born a girl, she would have constantly reminded me of my place, constantly told me to not get too big for my britches, to not set my sights too high. She would have encouraged me to get a college education and become a teacher because that was acceptable in that culture. That's what she did. But she never would have encouraged me to reach for the stars because she didn't know that she could.
Thank you for that, Paula. We have an audience member who sees women together in their own support groups and has discerned in that a lot of support that women can show for one another in those smaller groups. And so his question is, do women not support each other when it's just them, or is it they don't support each other when they're confronted by men?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. In my case, my experience has been in both environments. In female-only environments, it's probably been in my life a little bit worse than in mixed-gender environments. And I understand that sense of scarcity that exists. You know, you spend your entire life trying to get a C-suite office, and you do, and somebody else comes along and it's easier for this generation, and you think, oh, wait, no, you don't, you need to go through everything I went through. So I understand it. It's just not very productive. I find that the female relationships I have a depth, an honesty, and a strength that I've only known in one male relationship ever. That was not my father. I'm sorry, I'm so weepy. I'd be honest with all of you. I'm dealing with some things right now that have been really difficult. And so, you know, I always feel so badly for an audience when they're like, we don't know really what's going on. I mean, that, you know, something apparently is going on beneath the surface. And everybody gets uncomfortable when a speaker starts crying. You know, everybody kind of wants to look down and never quite knows how to deal with it. So I understand that it's a little bit off.
Thanks. And my thoughts and prayers to you for whatever it is that you're dealing with. But the nature of your story is so powerful. I have to say, as somebody who's been in the room with you while this has been going on, it's just landed for me as heartfelt. And I think, for what it's worth, we've all gotten a little weepy in here with you. So thank you for being willing to be authentic with us. I deeply appreciate that. Let's turn sort of the nature of the questions a little bit. It's a great question one of our listeners sent in, who wants to know how you've been nourished, delighted, surprised by your transition?
I think it's the line I put into that TED Talk, the discovery that the call toward authenticity is sacred and holy and for the greater good. The discovery that answering the call into the hero's journey is worth it, even though it's going to make you miserable first. There is a holiness. And I don't see myself, yes, I'm a pastor, and I said in my talk at TED Women, I believe in God most days except Tuesdays and Thursdays and any day I'm on the New Jersey Turnpike. Or I might add on I-95 on a Sunday night head back to Boston. I hold on to the concept of God lightly. But I do believe that there is a lightness of being that comes to you when you trust the flow of your life, even when it's going to take you over the worst waterfalls. When you trust that flow, you know that come what may, you'll eventually make it to the sea. The river knows where it's going. And so when you jump in and trust the flow, you'll make it to the sea. That, I think, I've discovered more than anything else. If I had known how difficult it would be, that I would lose my marriage, that I would lose thousands and thousands of friends. I knew 5,000 to 10,000 people by name in my old denomination, many of them right here in this state, people who've never reached out to me. One of my closest friends of 20 years lives not 30 minutes away from here, and he's never spoken to me again after I came out. So there's a lot of loss. But what you gain are people who are also on the hero's journey. Those who know there's life on the other side of the dark night of the soul. Those who have seen the light at the end of the tunnel and know that it's not an oncoming dream. And being in the company of those people, that makes it all worth it. Yeah, being in a place like this. You know, I can tell just in my correspondence with everyone here and meeting the few folks I've met today, you're likely not watching this unless you're one of those people. I had such a wonderful response to the book. And I was
remind us of the name of that book, Paul.
As a Woman, What I Learned About Power, Sex, and the Patriarchy After I Transitioned. But it was interesting. My favorite interviews, and I did about 30 over 40 days, but my favorite were not what people might think, People Magazine or Good Morning America. It was 1A on NPR. I'm a little bit of a Jen White fan.
Yeah.
And Minnesota Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Radio, and Colorado Public Radio. And it was because of the honest inquiry, the brilliance of the hosts, and because that's kind of who's listening to NPR, or those who know. I mean, that's my own prejudice, but I'm sticking with it.
Yeah. It's nice once in a while to preach to the choir, I agree.
It is, isn't it?
Or at least,
it?
You know, surround ourselves with those in the choir.
Because there are certainly enough days that you're not.
Absolutely. Amen. Amen.
Yeah, like People Magazine, for instance. Yeah, that's one you can be pretty, you know. Or Good Morning America. You know, there are times there you want to say, can we follow a train of thought in the interview process? Apparently, we don't need to go.
Paul, I want to thank you again so much for being with us this morning. When I heard you say in answer to one of the questions that, you know, you have this ginormous platform because you were born a man, and that is obviously true. And there's more. And you are obviously a person who did that journey on the thin road, who did the hero's journey. And you have a great heart and great insight. And we truly have been blessed to have you in our presence this morning. And thank you again for coming out here to New Hampshire. Friends, I hope you've enjoyed today's live broadcast of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. I want to thank you again for your support of our unique 2021 season. Please join us in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from now, to hear Elise Hooper speak about writing about overlooked women, which I think will be a lovely dovetail to today's program. Paula, thank you again for being with us, and thank you to everyone who made today's show possible.